Finance Division will come to order. It is January 16, 2013. For the record, a quorum is present. Welcome, everyone. I'm Chuck Weger. It's an honor to be the chair of this division. As you know, this is the most important division, the most important responsibility that we have at the legislature, education. And I congratulate each of you for and appreciate all that you have worked on in your campaign. And I know a part of that journey was talking about the concerns of education in your district. We're going to talk a great deal about that as we have a goal, and we'll meet that to have a bill ready in the next 90 days that will go to the Senate floor. And that'll be a reflection of our values as to how we improve education in our state. We're going to do introductions now, and we're going to ask that if we could keep it to about 2 minutes or so. We're not going to time it unless it gets really long. And there will be a few things. Tell us where you're born and your district, just a little bit about, you know, where it is and where you're living in the district. And if you'd like, a classroom teacher who may have had a big impact in your life. And so we'll reflect on that, and we'll also ask staff in introductions to do that as well, except what their district is. We have the certificates, but we appreciate your impact. And I'll start with myself. I was born in St. Paul, just a couple of blocks from here, and I live in Maplewood. My district includes North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, and then in further into Washington County, Matamidi, Birchwood, Willerney, and then White Bear Lake as well in the new redistricting. This is my 17th year on the committee, and I believe Senator Stumpf, who my previous chair, I've been on that journey with him over the years. I want to thank Senator Olson for her leadership over the past term, and I started with Senator Pogemiller. On the journey here, I had been on a school board, and I know a lot of you have that experience. But the teacher, and we're going to be reflecting a lot about our background, our district, and I look forward to that in our discussions because that's who we are. But I'd like to recognize Fred Stearns, who is a fifth grade teacher of mine at Richardson. It's called Richardson Elementary, previously North Elementary in North St. Paul. He was a fifth grade elementary teacher who inspired in everyone an appreciation for each other, a respect that each of us could achieve. And he tied everything into current events, whether it was math, reading assignments, obviously in social studies, but he had a way of connecting that. And I know he had a huge impact on many other students. So we appreciate that. And I say this because we know the parents are the number one impact on a student's success, but then it's that classroom teacher, and as we guide our discussions, it'll be also a reflection on our own lives. So thank you, Mr. Stearns. We're going to go next to staff and that work with the our committee, and then we're going to go around and have each of you introduce yourself. So Bert, you're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Bjorn Arneson. I work with Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis in a research analyst capacity. I was born in rural Yellow Medicine County and live now in St. Anthony Park neighborhood of St. Paul. The teacher that comes to mind for me is my kindergarten teacher, who happens also to be my godmother and a neighbor at the farm up the road. Her name was Ann Isaacson. She taught kindergarten for probably close to 40 years in my hometown. So anyone between the ages of, say, 7 and 50 had Mrs. Isaacson as a kindergarten teacher. And her husband was a city administrator in Cottonwood, and together they were a great role model for sort of community and civic engagement in my hometown. Thank you.
Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jay Wilms. I'm working for Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis as well. I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I currently live a few miles away in Minneapolis in the Prospect Park neighborhood. In terms of my favorite teacher, I went to high school out in Brookings, South Dakota, and my favorite teacher was a high school chemistry teacher. It really instilled, you know, a love of curiosity in me, and I think that was very valuable, and so yeah, he's who I'd like to recognize today.
I'm Danny Elling. I'm the committee administrator for the E-12 division. I was raised in Norwood, Young America, which is far western Carver County. Went to public school there my whole life, and the teacher I'd like to recognize is Mrs. Kathy Elfke. She was my sixth grade teacher. She instilled a love of writing, reading, and that those were the things that would get you far in life, and she was very much on the money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My name is Caitlin Snyder, and I am Senator Wieger's legislative assistant. I was born in Norfolk, Virginia. My dad was in the Navy. After he was honorably discharged, we moved back to Lake of the Woods, Minnesota, which is where my family's from, Senator Stump's district. The teacher I'd like to recognize is Mr. Klotz, who was a teacher at Malung Middle School, and he really challenged me. He'd even taught my mother 20-some years before, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Welcome, Caitlin. Bill? Yes.
Good morning. My name is Philip Childs. I am Senator Wieger's intern, and I was born in Minneapolis. I grew up in South Minneapolis, went to Southwest High School, and it happened to be a teacher from Southwest. His name is Mr. Yankovich. He was my woodshop and also my U.S. history teacher, and we had some great discussions on history. I had been working in the woodshop, which one of the reasons why I really enjoyed him was the fact that he had such a sense of humor that I actually enjoyed learning about history.
Thanks, Bill. We want to make sure we get into the microphone as well, so we may, for staff, have to have you come to the mic. Ms. Butler?
I'm Amory Butler, I'm the city council. This is the session of the committee. I was born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, and now I live in Woodbury. And my favorite teacher, or most influential teacher, was my first grade teacher, Ms. Hurley. She was a former nun, but she also kind of helped my attention to detail. It was one who took a lot of time to do like our drawing and stuff, and she was very encouraging when I actually got my stuff done in the amount of time we were supposed to do it. I would just do so much drawing and coloring and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of fun.
Thank you.
My name is Ryan Majerus, I'm for Senate Majority Research. Born in Manhattan, Kansas. And my most influential teacher was my 10th grade history teacher at Roosevelt High School. I subsequently took political science and economics with Mr. Beth Meyer. And every day in class, no matter what class it is, he tied into current events by asking what, and still does, ask what is going on in the world today, and sort of discussion of what's happening around the world, keep students aware of what's happening.
Thanks. Yep.
Hello, Ed Cook. I'm with the Center Republican Caucus. I'm a research staff. And I was born in Geneva, Illinois. I would say I remember most influential was a high school freshman year English teacher. I had always done a lot of reading, but not much writing, and she got me writing.
Thanks. Ed, how many years have you been with us?
Let's see. This is 22 with the Senate.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Jason?
I'm Jason Keenley. I work in the revisor's office. I was born in Dayton, Ohio, recruited to Minnesota by my wife, who's a native Minnesotan, who I met in college. Similar to Ed's story, my favorite teacher was my senior AP English teacher, who was the first person who really got me writing. A lot of that. So I oversee both education, finance, and policy, early childhood and K-12 in the director's office.
Ed, we're going to go to Senator Johnson. But first, we're going to ask Eric Nauman the same question. You're a part of this larger staff team.
Senator Wieger, thank you. My name is Eric Nauman. I'm the lead fiscal analyst. Previously, I served this committee for about 15 years as its fiscal analyst, and it feels a little strange to be sitting at this end of the table as opposed to the other end of the table, but I thank you for allowing me to come back for what I've been promised is the last time. See, I grew up in Sacramento, California, lived on the East Coast for a number of years where I went to graduate school. I'm going to list Dr. Henry Raimondo as the influential teacher in my life. He was an economist for the New York, New Jersey Port Authority and was also my graduate advisor. And unfortunately, he died at too young of an age. But he taught me how to laugh, and so I miss him a great deal. I think that covers the waterfront. I now serve the body as the lead fiscal analyst, so I'm sure we'll be working together soon.
And also I want to acknowledge Mike and preface that by saying I started my early career here as an intern as a page for this committee in 1972. So I fully appreciate for the next generation coming up how we may have an inspiration for that, hopefully. So go ahead.
Okay, I'm Mike, and I'm the page for this committee, and I grew up in Wayzata, Minnesota. I was born in Edina, and my most influential teacher was my teacher in college. He was my professor in most of my history classes, and he inspired me on my study of World War II. So.
Great, thank you.
All right.
I was born on my family's farm in Benton County, out near Duellum, Minnesota. I graduated from Foley High School, so it's like 7 miles from Foley. And I live in Spring Lake Park now. I represent District 37, which includes Blaine, all of the city of Blaine, practically. Parts of Coon Rapids and part of Spring Lake Park. My teacher, I went to a country school for the first 8 years of my life. We didn't have kindergarten then, and I'm not really that old, but we just didn't have it at that time in the country. So there were 30 kids with eight grades and one teacher.
Wow.
V. Pearl Meyer, Mrs. Meyer. She was absolutely stunning. I don't ever remember her saying a cross word. We played softball. She taught every grade everything. And we had like Christmas programs and Halloween parties. And, you know, I think it just made the school was just an absolute delight for me. I wanted always to be away from that farm where we had to dig in the dirt and stuff like that when we were gardening. So I think it set the tone for me and my great and honest respect for teachers, I think, comes from her.
Thank you, Sarah Johnson. I'm going to ask everyone if you could put your name badge at so it's facing the presenter table and also so that we can all see each other a little better. I know who you are. Okay. Senator Stumpf.
My name is Leroy Stumpf, and I was going to say I'm the newcomer on this committee, except when I looked at the first sheet, I realized that I had voted for the the early property tax recognition in 1983, so I can't really say it. My district is Senate District 1, which is way up in the northwest corner of the state, and there's the towns, I think, they're probably more identifiable than the counties up there, like Thief River Falls, East Grand Forks, War Road, Roseau, Crookston. Those are some of the larger communities up there. And the teacher that that comes to mind is a man that's Edgar Skowiak, and he was a physics teacher, and he was similar to a lot of the ones that you mentioned that inspired a lot of, you know, just curiosity and interest in learning things. Something always was happening in his class, you know, either an explosion or something. And it drove the kind of the sense of learning that I think think is so important. And I think it's something that's missing sometimes in education today is that desire to find out and research and do things. And so anyway, that's a person that kind of inspired me.
Is there stuff you were born where?
Actually, my hometown area is a community west of here, Waverly, Minnesota.
Sure.
In a township that Hubert Humphrey used to always come out to and for a thrashing activities in the fall.
Thank you, Sandra. Bye.
Thank you. I represent Minnetonka and Plymouth, and I grew up in Edina, so I went to grade school all through high school in Edina. And in terms of my favorite teacher, the one that I think of is Carol Skluzacek, and she was my fifth grade teacher. She read to us every day, which, thinking back, it seems like fifth grade might be a little old to be reading to, but after recess and after lunch, we would all sit down on the floor, and she would read to us, and she read Johnny Tremaine. And I still remember her voice as she, was Sybil or Johnny, and that still is probably my favorite book because I can remember her reading it. And then also what I remember about her is that her husband was in the war at the time, and so sometimes she would just pause, and her eyes would fill with tears, and she would say, just say a prayer for my husband. And hope he comes home. So it was a meaningful year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonhoff, just the other night I was sitting down with my children while my wife read. So even 44 isn't too old to be getting read to. It was about the Wright brothers, by the way. I'm Sean Nino. I live in Cambridge. I represent roughly Chisago and Isanti counties. Not quite all of both of those, but the majority of both of
those. And, Senator, we also asked where you're born.
Oh, I was born in Anoka.
Okay.
Born in Anoka, which I think at the time was part of the current Senate district that I represent. It's how little population there was in that area back then, I think. I'm not 100% certain on that. And my favorite teacher, I would say Tim Newton was the teacher. I went to a small, for my last couple of years of high school, into a small private school. And I remember having the conversation with him after I'd been there for a while and they'd seen my test scores. And I was one of those students that had aptitude way up here and motivation way down here. And he pulled me aside and said, look, you're not living up to your potential. And that was helpful.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Hall. I was born in Minneapolis General Hospital and lived in about 8 different homes in South Minneapolis. But I represent Burnsville, where I live, Savage, and a little bit of Lakeville. My favorite teachers typically were my coaches in high school, Jack Osberg, and in Ed Sagersted in college. And they're probably for the same reasons. Ed was my kinesiology professor. Jack was my biology professor. And they taught me how to think. And as coaches, that's a little different, not just in the classroom, but you get close to your coaches when you're out every day working with them, and they push you harder than you expect to be pushed. And I think that's where I got the values that I use, which are work hard, play fair, do the right thing, and expect the best out of yourself and others every day.
Okay. I'm Vicki Jensen. I represent Senate District 24. I was born in Platte, South Dakota. I moved to Minnesota when I was 2 years old and graduated from Appleton High School, which is now Lacaparo Valley. So when I brought my kids back for a reunion and tried to show them, the school wasn't there, the bowling alley we used to hang out wasn't there. It was kind of sad. But I live in Owatonna now, and the counties that I represent are parts of Rice, just about all of Steele, Dodge, and Waseca counties. The teacher that I would like to recognize is my junior high band instructor, Mr. Finley. He, when you're a tall, young girl, and I was the only girl that was in the percussion section, and you stand at the back, and he recognized that I was slouching
I was trying to become smaller than what I should be and what my potential was, and he told me about it. He said, stand up, be tall and proud, stand tall and proud, and I took that with me for the rest of my life. So the impact that teachers make, and just even that small, that seems small, when you think about everything that happens in your life, I'll remember it to this day. So I commend teachers for recognizing some of those things that they can do, too.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm Melissa Halverson-Wickland. I was born in Minneapolis and grew up in Bloomington. I represent a large part of Bloomington, the area that I grew up in, actually, and have lived all my life, and then also a large part of Richfield. And as far as influential teachers, it's hard for me to decide. I have teachers in my family. My mom was a math teacher for 25 years. My grandmother was a math teacher and a pioneer in doing and teaching math in Alexandria. And my grandfather was a teacher. So lots of important influences on my life. In terms of a influential teacher in high school, John Kuklish was my journalism teacher, and I was on the yearbook staff, and he was someone who, you know, influenced my love of writing and writing well, and also just how to bring out the best of in everybody, you know, in his realm, and how we can all do that. So, I guess that he was very influential. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Karen Housley. I represent Senate District 39, which is the Stillwater area, and Forest Lake down to St. Mary's Point, where I currently live. I was born at Fairview Hospital in Minneapolis, where my grandfather was a professor across the street at Augsburg, and raised in South St. Paul, Minnesota. My father was, well, I don't know if he was my favorite teacher, but I better say that. He was a teacher at South St. Paul High School for 33 years. He taught Phi Ed and history, and he was also the head basketball coach. And in our family, you weren't allowed to go to any other sport besides basketball, especially the rival South St. Paul Packer hockey team. And so I didn't do very much wrong in high school except date a hockey player. So, I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. My biggest thing was I dated a hockey player. So there was a little turmoil in our house. They've gotten over it since, but my father was probably my favorite teacher.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Senator Weir, thank you. My name is John Hoffman, and I represent Senate District 36, which is northern part of Brooklyn Park, Champlin, and then a portion of Coon Rapids. I was born in Casper, Wyoming. My father was a geologist, and I still have rock core samples from the day back then. And I grew up in Hollywood Township, which is out by Watertown, Minnesota. So, yes, there is a Hollywood Township. And
how many knew that?
Close to Waverly. three teachers. First grade teacher, Linda Orsted. She taught us how to play in a sandbox. She taught people how to cooperate. And I never forgot that. She was kind. In high school, it was Bruce Bogenrief, who was a social studies teacher and influenced my greater look at potential and about flexibility and change. And then in college, Father Andrew Fabian, who was our philosophy professor, and I think he's still alive to this day in St. Mary's, and would say, good, better, best, never let it rest. Good become better, better become. And then everybody would yell best. And to this day, 20-some years later, it still is as fresh as it is yesterday. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Weber from Laverne, Minnesota. I represent Senate District 22, which is all our parts of nine counties in southwest Minnesota. And I have, in fact, some of the freshman senators, when we were at our orientation session, said, you have to report with nine different county boards, and they offered me their condolences at that point. But anyway, my district shares 130-some miles of border with South Dakota and Iowa, and so I always say we're your first line of defense against both South Dakota and Iowa. anyway, as I said, I grew up in Laverne. I still live in Laverne, and I grew up on a farm 8 miles southwest of Laverne. And my favorite teacher was my seventh grade history teacher, Gerald Husson, who just passed away last year. He was very insistent. He said, always make sure, as you study history, that you have received the facts of history as they occurred, not as somebody wishes to portray them. Because only, he said, with the true facts of history can you learn the lessons that are available there. And so I've remembered that always and have always striven to find what the facts are as opposed to what somebody wishes to have them be in their own mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wigger. My name is Susan Kent, and I represent District 53, which is in the East Metro. It's all of Woodbury, Landfall, and then the southern parts of Maplewood and Oakdale. I was born at the opposite end of the Mississippi River in New Orleans and grew up there. And, yes, we do raise children there. It is actually a good place to have a family. People are surprised by that. It was a great place for my education and history, but it was also, as everybody knows, it's got a complicated situation with education, which has informed my views on it in many, many ways. And part of why I chose to move here with my husband, who's from Maplewood, and that's how we've ended up here. I have the same problem. I have a lot of teachers in my family, and I've been blessed with so many different teachers, so it's really hard to pick. My grandfather was the youngest superintendent from the state of Alabama, and he met my kindergarten teacher grandmother when they were working together. The passion for education runs on both sides of my family and is a big part of why being on this committee is important to me. But the teacher I want to single out is Karen Greenberg. She was the drama teacher, taught drama history, and was the drama coach, and I was a drama geek. And it was the work ethic, it was the teamwork, the working together to put on that production, just the values behind it, all the while learning a lot about an important art form and language and so many other things. So she passed away last year, and I miss her deeply, and she was a big influence on my life. Thank you.
I'm Gary Deems, and I represent Senate District 16, which includes six counties in southwestern Minnesota. I start in southern Brown County and go all the way along the river to the South Dakota border. My district is about 187 miles from corner to corner, so it's a fairly large district. I was born and raised in Springfield, Minnesota, and currently live just west of Redwood Falls, Minnesota. When I look back at my high school education, there's two teachers that really stand out. One teacher was our eighth grade English teacher, Betty Sales, and the other one was our ag and natural science teacher, Ben Broberg. And I think the reason these two teachers really stand out is they always made sure that they pushed very hard to get each student to work to their maximum potential. And Betty Sales in particular had a real good way of bringing out if she didn't think you were. And I was born and raised on a farm, so it was a real nice spring day, and it was one of those days the sun is out and there's a nice breeze, and this was before air conditioning in school, so we had all the windows open, and I was kind of sitting there looking out the window and just kind of daydreaming probably about the day, as nice as a day as it was. And she was standing in front of the room, and she stopped her lecturing. She said to Mr. Deems, and I happened to look at the clock. She said, I see you're looking at the clock. She said, I just want to remind you, time is passing. I'm not so sure that you are. She had a real good way of keeping you in tune to why you were there and what you're supposed to be doing. And I will never forget that.
Senator Kevin Dahl of Northfield and Senate District 20, which includes Northfield, Belle Plaine, New Prague, Le Sueur, and several communities in between. I'm a teacher, 29 years in Minnesota, so all of those 29, even though I was born in Forest City, Iowa, born and raised there. I'm not my favorite teacher necessarily. I can do better sometimes, but probably my grandmother. She pretty much raised 11 children on her own, but she was a teacher for over 30 years, and much of that time in a one-room schoolhouse. But she, probably because of her, instilled my love of reading, the Outstanding Penmanship Award, first, second, and third grade, and the third grade spelling bee champ in Forest City, Iowa. So because of her, I think. So I pay tribute to her.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Eric Pratt. I was just assigned to this committee this week. So I don't think I'm on the official roster yet, but hopefully that's coming soon. I was born in Charles City, Iowa, but I was raised in Prior Lake, Minnesota. I currently represent Northern Scott County, Senate District 55, which includes Shakopee, Jordan, and Prior Lake.
I spent 12 years on the Prior Lake School Board, where I served as chairman and treasurer. I'm very proud of what we've accomplished in Prior Lake Savage with getting our fiscal house in order, as well as making sure that our students achieve it at levels never seen before in Prior Lake, and it's always been recognized as a very strong district. I'd have to say my favorite teacher was my mother, Sue Pratt. She taught for 40 years, nearly 25 years in Shakopee as a sixth grade teacher. Not only did she teach me my values, the value of a strong education, but she also taught me about community service. She didn't necessarily view her job as strictly a vocation, but an avocation and a way to give back to the community.
Thank you.
My name is Patricia Torres Ray, and I represent District 63, which is Southeast Minneapolis and part of Richville. I was born in Colombia, South America, and I went to a Catholic school from pre-K to 12th grade. Actually, in Colombia, you graduate in 11th grade. So I grew up with nuns, Catholic nuns, that were incredibly strict, and there was almost zero tolerance for deviating from the rules to a point that you could get expelled. And that was just really the worst thing that could happen to a Catholic girl in a small town, that you could be expelled from your school. So that was, for me, my life growing up. And perhaps for me, if I think about, you know, this small group of all women, the most important and most influential woman in my life was my principal, the principal of my school, because she had this ability to kind of let you know that she expected excellence, but you loved her anyway, and that she was, you know, this very strict woman who, you know, call you if she suspected that you were going to get a C. You were in her office having, you know, meetings with your parents and everything, even before it happened. But I have, you know, great memories of even being in her office. So I think she was tremendously influential in my life.
Hi, I'm Tom Saxog. I represent District 5. I was born and raised in Grand Rapids, which is on the east side of my district. The west side is Bemidji, and both those cities have large and pretty progressive school districts, early childhood programs. In the middle of the district is the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, kind of overlaid by the Chippewa National Forest, and there we see a lot of small consolidated school districts. The real problem in northern Minnesota is that we have all that public land and consequently don't have a lot of tax base. And, of course, when the pressure is on property taxes for education, that is a problem. My favorite teacher was my eighth grade English teacher, Bob Elkington. I met Bob in fifth grade. He was my basketball coach, and but when by the time we got to eighth grade, and you all know what eighth graders are going through, it's that time. And during the week, he was very organized. On Monday and Friday, we'd do literature. On Tuesday and Thursday, we'd do grammar, and then we'd do compositions on Wednesday. And I probably learned more in that 1 year than I did the rest of my junior high school career. That's what we called it, junior high school then. Bob Elkington was a teacher, coach. Eventually, he would be administrator, and then later he served on the school board. 10 years ago, they named the new middle school in Grand Rapids after him, Robert Elkington Middle School. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Senators, for sharing about yourself. You're a fascinating group. And I feel really excited about the next several weeks as we address the number one challenge that the legislature has, and that's our students, our future. It's not only that nearly 1 million students in school and early learners. It's the employers, the parents, and the others that also have a strong interest in what we are going to be doing. And so I know how important it is in your respective communities. They're going to be looking to you for guidance and want you to know that whatever I can do as it relates to the in your own area as well for particular items, let me know. A few housekeeping items. If you ever need to reach me and it's something that's really important where you can't get through directly right at the Senate office, my cell phone is, you can call or text 651-770-0283. In terms of overall committee decorum rules, common sense, golden rule, and respect. Respecting one another, doing our best to respect the time when we start, and we totally recognize that you have visits from constituents and meetings in the community, and we all will be in and out from time to time. But if you do not think you're going to be here or there's something, if you can let staff know just for quorum purposes and making sure that, you know, we miss you and we want to make sure that you're included to the extent we can. So letting us know if you're not able to make it. I do want to try to start on time as period. So in terms of any other items, we have listed Monday through Friday as committee dates. We generally will meet Tuesday to Thursday, Monday and Fridays if necessary. Recognizing for those of you that, you know, with district obligations, oftentimes there might be something on a Monday, or and especially if you're in greater Minnesota and traveling for Friday, we want to try to keep that open for you. And some advice, not that you need it, but visit a school in your district if you have a chance on that Friday. I know that you're connected already. And to the extent you can, see if you can visit a school in another district as well. I know they'd love to have you. And I offer that invitation. If you ever want me to visit a particular school, let me know. And not during session, but in interim or beyond, we'll be looking at some greater visitations to look at best practices, needs, and we'll coordinate that with the Senator's Race Committee as well. So in terms of the overall schedule over the next couple of weeks, it'll be background on education finance. We're going to hear from one of the best in Eric shortly. And tomorrow you're going to hear from perhaps the authority on school finance, Dr. Tom Melcher from the Department of Education. And he will give an update and some background, and we can have some Q&A on the work group on school finance. And there's been a great deal of work that has been done, as you know, in developing a report, and we're going to hear that. It'll obviously be something that's going to get a lot of consideration over the next several weeks as we prepare a bill that'll go to the floor and ultimately to conference. The following week, as you know, the governor is going to present his budget, and we tentatively have scheduled a joint meeting with the House. I discussed this with Representative Marquardt, and so the following day, which I believe would be the 23rd, we would have a joint meeting with the House to get the overview from the department on the budget and have a chance also to see our House colleagues and at least have a preliminary overview on that. There will also be a day, perhaps the next day on the 24th, where we'll ask various groups, stakeholders we call them, but any of the groups that would like to, you know, share their concerns, perhaps a 10-minute overview. I ask maybe a one-page summary, but attach as much as you want. But just to share concerns, you know, with the committee overall at goals of their organization or that they might personally have, and that's tentatively set for the 24th. Beyond that, it's open, but we'll start the bill hearing process perhaps within a week or two after that. I think we have one bill in now, but there will be plenty. And for hearing requests, if you do want it heard, I recognize sometimes bills are introduced and there is not a request, and I found that out the hard way once. But if you do want it to be heard, put in the request, and we'll, Dana, if you could just tell us how that works, especially for the new members.
There is a form that you can fill out, and then you email it to me, and then I will be in contact to discuss when the hearing, when we will schedule the hearing. My email, please note my first name has two N's. It's danna.elling@senate.mn. If you just start typing that, it should come up. I've been here long enough that the system knows who I am. And then I will be in contact with you to find out what the situation is and when we might be hearing the bill. And you can always call if you have other questions. Just call me at 296-7089.
Good. And how many are also on education policy? Okay. So we're going to get to know each other really well, and working with Senator Torres Ray, and we want to maximize the coordination for hearings, and we're working on that right now, and there's different meetings that are going on to assess priorities, and obviously our priority is the budget, but we'll be looking at a number of policy items with fiscal implications, and that process will be announced in the near future with some of what's going to be noted. In fact, Senator Torres Ray, if you did want to just give a brief update, I believe you do have a committee meeting scheduled.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have a meeting tomorrow, and we are going to follow a similar path in terms of just kind of providing an overview of the different reports that are out so that all the members will have the information that is available, will be available to the public. I think it's online right now. And then after the governor announces his budget, we're going to begin to review some of the policy implications. So we're trying to coordinate with the budget committee as much as we can to make sure that we talk about the policy aspects of those bills, and then we are going to have a lot to review just in terms of policy in our committee. So we're going to do the same in terms of reviewing overall proposals and ideas, reports that were requested by, during the last 2 years, and then move on to have hearings on specific bills after that.
And also, in addition to working with the policy committee, it's going to be very important to have a close linkage with the higher ed, because it's not everything in one silo. And as Senator Bonoff, we talked about this recently, but perhaps you'd like to just mention how we plan to coordinate that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the higher ed committee, and there are people around this table who are on, so if you're on the higher ed, is it just Senator Kent? Is that the only one? Okay.
Senator Peterson.
Oh, and, right.
We have at least four.
Oh, very good. Okay. So anyways, we have identified some key indicators that really overlap, and one of them is students coming to post-secondary who aren't yet ready for post-secondary. We talk about early childhood being not yet ready, but we have a huge problem of remediation needed by the time they get to school. And so we'll be working with the K-12 Education Committee to figure out what is the best way to work back, and really probably down to 9th grade. Another area where we want to work closely is the ideas around mentorship and making sure that as kids leave our K-12 system that they have a clear understanding of the best program that they ought to be looking at for post-secondary. And then our graduation rates, unfortunately, are way less than acceptable in our post-secondary schools. And so how can we mentor those young people right out of high school and sort of that gap time to make sure they do complete? And I think those are areas of partnership between the committees, and I look forward to doing that.
Great. And so the key point we want you to know, we're working with the other committees, and obviously tax committee is have a huge review of what we end up with as well, and potentially some other committees. So no further ado, I'd like to ask Mr. Nauman to give us the presentation on education finance overview. We'll try to hold on questions for at least 30 minutes or so, And if there's any items that we have a need for follow-up, we'll ask either to set up something with Eric or maybe another meeting we can have. But let's roll out as much as we can first by getting the overview.
Mr. Chairman and members, it is a pleasure to return. First, welcome back to the returning members, and it's always fun to come to this committee because there's always new faces in it the first day of session. By custom and practice, both the House and the Senate in their respective K-12 committees tend to do a education finance overview. They take a little bit different format. The House tends to take a little bit more time, more committee sessions. Our practice is to give you what you're about to endure and then offer up more detailed explanations later. So I'll say that at the front end, this may feel overwhelming. There is a bit of meat in here. If you haven't sat through this before, there's going to be things that are going to come at you, new terms, new concepts. We do our best to unpack those, but we suggest on the front end that there will be some complexities here and some ifs, ands, and buts, like anything else in your business. And that's why we have the nonpartisan staff here to offer assistance. And I'm very, very pleased to hand off the baton to both Jay Wilms and Bjorn Arneson. I was involved in their hiring process, which took far too much time, but we are very happy to have them here. So I know that they are in capable hands. Senator Rieger, you mentioned at the outset maybe a half an hour. Frankly, I have to confess we've got a lot more here than a half an hour. So,
For some questions. Certainly. I don't think we're going to endure 90 minutes of nonstop.
Okay. Well, you keep me on task. What I've done is organize this. We'll talk a little. The advertising section at the beginning is the role of the nonpartisan staff, so you know why we're here and what we do. We'll then talk about the Constitution and then some basic terms that we think are useful to have in your back pocket. And when Dr. Melcher appears tomorrow, he'll start throwing some of these things at you, and it's useful to have them at least be conversationally aware that they exist. Then some pupil accounting and the budgets, and then we begin to crawl into some of the actual formulas. If time gets tight, we may skip over some of the special ed through the agency budgets because they're covered in some earlier slides in less detail. But what I would like to do is to end with the education shifts. How many are aware that there are education shifts, even if you don't know how they work? I figured
four
that
hands.
Only four hands? I expected everyone in the room to be aware. There's been a lot of conversation. One of the things to shorten up this briefing is we put a lot of the trend information at the very end. I'm happy to answer questions about them, but I'm not going to speak to them directly. So,
excuse me. Members, make sure we all have the documents. There's an outline. Everyone should have that. And then there's some supplemental budget run information.
And, Mr. Chairman, members, there's a slide where I'll make reference to some of the things that are in the briefing. Okay. What did I – sorry. Okay. So this is the – as I mentioned, this is the advertising section. Typically each budget division, and you are a division of the Finance Committee here in E-12, has three nonpartisan staff, a research analyst, that's Bjorn, counsel, Anne-Marie Butler. She has served this committee for longer than I did. And is an excellent resource. And Jay Wilms is your fiscal analyst. Our role typically divides up into a variety of different tasks. We analyze spending and revenue proposals. We aid the committee in developing and analyzing budgetary options. We'll draft legislation, amendments, the technical documents that you have in front of you. We track the effect of budget decisions, track the budget effect of legislative decisions. We provide analysis for legislative oversight of enacted budgets, research policy initiatives, and the council will sometimes be called upon to offer legal opinions. So these are all the roles that we play. We often will sit in with meetings if that's necessary. You have somebody that is coming to visit you and you want to have a technical conversation, that's a good place for us to be helpful as you're beginning to craft a bill. I'd like to now call your attention to the packet that you have in front of you. Typically, there will be a series of documents that get rolled out at various points in the discussion. Budget books will be prepared by the executive branch, and those will be made available to you. They offer a lot more detail. They have typically offered a lot more detail than the information that is in this briefing. But, for example, details about what the governor proposes in his budget this year will be examined in detail, as well as current law. Fiscal notes are an executive branch function that the legislature plays a role in. You introduce a bill. We think it has a fiscal cost. It's got a hearing in front of it. There might be occasions where we would want to measure that fiscal cost before to assist the committee's deliberation. Fiscal notes will be prepared by the executive branch and presented to the committee. And we do have an example of one of those. I think it's Senator Wieger's all-day kindergarten bill from a few years back. And sometimes they can be somewhat dense. The headline on the front, of course, is always the most important thing. What does the bill cost? But you'll find that it's always useful to look at the assumptions. What is built inside the fiscal note? I can see Senator Kent has the copy in front of her. That's what we're talking about. Sometimes they're just a single page. For example, a fund transfer bill will have a very short fiscal note. Then next, moving on, is some of the documents that our office prepares. This committee is unique in that it has both an aid function and a property tax function. So there are two spreadsheets that get prepared that travel with your omnibus bill. I presume there'll be an omnibus bill that funds the K-12 system for the next 2 years. You will have an aid tracking sheet. That is the fiscal analyst's primary responsibility. In this particular case, it's titled Education FY 2014 Budget Supplemental. It has the end of session numbers on it from last year, as well as the November forecast data. It's organized by all the various accounts, some of which we'll talk about today, and then the columns orient the various fiscal years and then track changes. Changes can occur because the pupil counts change, for example. So you would see a change between the end of session and the forecast because we've updated for new pupil counts. So that's just a rudimentary example of how things change. There's also a property tax tracking spreadsheet. Yes. Labeled in slightly different font, Education FY 2014 through 15. In this case, it's organized to provide you a whole series of historical data all the way back to fiscal year 2002. Some of that history can be useful. It will probably be the last time you see all that history in this format. In most cases, the spreadsheet will be organized by Mr. Wilms to show you the effect of the immediate decision. So have we made a decision in this committee that makes changes to the property taxes? And I should mention that this committee will also receive what's called an aid target. How much money can this committee spend? It can be expressed as a positive number or a negative number, and then also a levy target. So it's important to consider both sides of the ledger as it gets worked through. And then the general education entitlements. That's the portrait-oriented document with legal sheets. Because of shifts and other calculations, it's sometimes useful to see what is actually happening inside general education. And that sheet will, in the end, will be organized with the February forecast on the top, the Senate bill in the middle, and then any differences down below. So if you add $50 to the formula, as was done 2 years ago, that would show up as a change in two or three different items because of the way the formulas are linked together. And then finally, I'm getting close. I think these documents are useful for you to be aware of as the papers start flying at you. You know what they are. Sometimes we will plot out allocations of a various piece of legislation. How does a bill that adds $50 to the formula distribute those dollars by school district? And that's a data run. I think the one that I included in the packet today was from 2 years ago, last year, when we made some adjustments to the Literacy Incentive Aid, which is a new program, and that shows how those dollars distributed based on the data that we had available last year. And now, finally, a bill summary. Many bills are complicated, and we, as a staff, will put together language that simplifies it, puts it in some usable language. All those English teachers that we heard about that affected us very importantly
gives us. We're looking at Senator Benson's review on concussion.
proposal?
Indeed. Okay. So that's a typical summary that gets produced out of our office. Mr. Chair, are there questions on those documents before I move into the meat and potatoes of the briefing?
Members?
Okay. Good. Okay. This briefing always begins with the Constitution. I think it's useful to spend a little time, just a few moments, taking a look at it, reading it. Unlike most other budget divisions, you have a roadmap for how to think about education. The Constitution prescribes a prescriptive role for the legislature, and it is the stability of a republican form of government depending mainly upon the intelligence of the people. It is the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. I think it's useful to have that in the back of your head. There are a whole collection of interpretations of what that language means. We could spend the rest of this committee meeting batting back and forth what indeed we think it means. I give it to you now because I think it can support a lot of thinking and encourage you to debate things in the context of this constitutional requirement. I think it, unlike other committees, gives you a roadmap that can be useful to think through. Now we'll jump into some basic terms. You'll probably hear tomorrow Dr. Melcher talk about revenue. These are dollars that schools have available to spend. In K-12, we think about revenue as what school districts are actually spending. Those dollars can come from two primary sources: levies, which are raised from taxation, on property taxation, and state aid. These are dollars that we actually appropriate. And for many formulas, a good rule of thumb is that revenue equals levy plus aid, although in many cases we calculate it as in reverse, where the aid is equal to the revenue minus the levy. And that has to do with the vagaries of how some of the formulas are constructed. A couple of other terms that you'll begin to hear, it's a bit of an alphabet soup. ANTC is the adjusted net tax capacity. It's a tax base that we use in many of the K-12 formulas to measure the relative wealth per pupil of that district. Another tax base that gets used is RMKV, referendum market value. This is primarily used on the operating referendum. This is when you go to the polls and the school districts are requesting additional dollars per kid. That if approved, that levy gets imposed on the referendum market value. And that tax base excludes seasonal recreational property as well as agricultural lands. We often talk about an allowance. That's a useful term to know. That's a statutorily determined number that, when multiplied by the number of pupils, generates revenue for school districts. We'll talk about a good example with that in the basic formula allowance. Equalization is a process of reducing the impact of property wealth to generate revenue for school districts by appropriating state aid. So the less wealthy a school district is, the more state aid for a given amount of revenue. And that typically exists on a sliding scale. That process is called equalization. An equalization factor works together with equalization. That's a statutorily determined amount of tax capacity per pupil that determines the amount of aid and levy in a given district. There may be questions about that as we go, but for now, let's just take them as definitions. A few more that we talk about. An aid entitlement. Gave you that sheet at the beginning for the general education with the three boxes. Those are entitlements. And that's 100% of a state aid a district or a charter school is eligible to receive in a given fiscal year. However, the aid may actually be paid out over two separate years. We divide that separation as a current year payment, which is the percentage of the entitlement that's paid in the current fiscal year, and the final payment, which is the percent of the entitlement that's paid in the second year. And this remember these, because these will tie directly into our discussion about the aid payment shift when we get there. The payment schedule is the schedule that expresses the education entitlements that are paid as the current year versus the final. Again, this is part of the shift calculation. We say that we are not shifting when we are at 90-10. I'll just give you that. So they must add to 100%. And finally, in an education context, appropriation is the amount of state aid that the state pays to districts and charter schools over a given year. And in most cases, that appropriation consists of a portion of the aid entitlement from the current year added to the final payment from the previous fiscal year. Okay. Now, pupil accounting. Here's a little bit more of the alphabet soup that you'll become conversant with, and you'll go home and talk to your spouses at dinner and start talking about ADMs, WADMs, and AMCPUs. And when you do, please call me and let me know, and I'll be happy to hear that. An ADM is the average daily membership. Essentially, it's a pupil count made basically every day and averaged over the course of the number of school days in the at the district level, how many school days they have on the school calendar. WADMs are the weighted average daily membership, and I've got a slide in a second that shows how we weight kids by grade. And then AMCPUs and RMCPUs is an economic calculation that's relates to an adjusted marginal cost pupil unit or a resident marginal cost pupil unit. I'll talk about that in more detail. One of your predecessors that sat on this committee when we first adopted the marginal cost calculation, Senator Krentz, said to me, "Now, Mr. Nauman, students are not marginal." And I said, "I understand that, Senator. This is more of an economic calculation. So please don't be put off by the title. I'm not suggesting it's a good idea to do this. This is an endorsement of the policy. I'm just telling you how it works." So we also have other pupil counts that we do for compensatory pupils and LEP pupils, extended time pupils. We've had slides on that in the past. I'm not going to burden you with them today, but to know that they exist as separate pupil counts for LEP relates to students that have limited ability to speak English, and we count those kids differently for some of the formulas. Compensatory is a count that we use for kids that are measured as poorer children, and those generate dollars in some of the other formulas. I think that more or less, it's a little bit more alphabet soup. This is the detail on the weighted average daily membership. So again, this is where students are weighted by grade. Pre-K and kindergarten disabled students are weighted at 1.25. Regular kindergarten students are weighted at 0.612. Grades 1 to 3, 1.115. 4 to 6, 1.06. And 7 to 12 is 1.3. Someone will ask me why. There's a long legislative history behind some of this. What's important to know is that we take these weights and then ultimately multiply them through the formula. So the higher the weight, the more dollars. The economists in the room will say, well, you could rebaseline these numbers to be something like 1. And Dr. Melcher, through the workforce or the task force last fall, talked about maybe we should have something that does equal 1, so at least we have a reference point. These are residuals of legislative history where the weights get added. I think it was 1999 when the 1.06 was extended up to 1.115 through grades 1.3, and it was a class size reduction initiative. So the legislature had an intent behind why those dollars were added through that mechanism. 0.612, the higher you make that number, the closer you get to all-day kindergarten. So I think there's already been a bill introduced that would make the 0.612 a 1.115. So you get the idea of how that would work. Here's our marginal cost pupil unit. We have both a marginal count for students that are resident to a district and are served by a district and a public school. The reason for the distinction is primarily the operating referendum, which is approved on the resident count, because there is a locus for the operating referendum. And essentially, we take the weighted pupils and we... districts that are in decline count 77% of this year's WADMs and add them to 23% of last year's WADMs, and together they equal the resident or adjusted marginal cost pupil units. Growing school districts count only the current year WADMs as their AMCPUs. This was put in place to ease the effect of the decline when a school district is in declining enrollment. So the theory being that as you have fewer kids, in a school, you don't lose the effect of a teacher all at once. So, but the loss of that kid would be a larger burden. So the notion is, let's ease the decline. Why 77-23? We had a school business manager in, I think it was the Apple Valley School District at the time, who was a former nonpartisan staffer here, who had done some analysis. It was the only analysis that we had, and that seemed to be a good number, but it looks really precise, but it was based on a little bit of research that we had at the time. Next, moving on to the calendar, this is more a finance committee conversation, but it's useful to be aware of how you interact with the fiscal years. Remember, our fiscal years begin on July 1st and end on June 30th. We are in the midst of that bar in the middle, off to the left, where it says fiscal 23. We've already had the November 2012 forecast, and the next step in the process, and we've begun the legislative session. The next step in the process is the governor's biennial budget submission. We will then get a February 2013 forecast, which will be the numbers that we actually use for constructing the budget. So the November forecast begins the conversation. It sets the numbers that are used to support the governor's budget. But then the February forecast is what the committees actually use to create the final budget. The governor will reprice his budget after the February forecast, so that is a step that's not really mentioned on here, but it's part of the conversation. And then on July 1st, 2013, we will have we'll be into the beginning of the next biennium, and you'll see that with regular processes, there's a forecast that gives you updates of the existing biennium as we move forward. Are there questions about that calendar?
Sarah Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman, it says the governor's capital budget submission in 2014. Doesn't it also occur at some point? And if so, when would that be that the governor would submit a capital budget request in a traditional budget
year? It's a very good question. There is a statutory requirement, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, that requires organizations that are seeking a capital budget request to go through a formal process with the executive branch of submitting requests and having them reviewed and receiving an agency recommendation, and then that recommendation is either accepted or not accepted as a governor's submission, and it's all aligned to the even year sessions. With that said, this committee itself doesn't typically have a lot of capital budget requests, so I kind of skipped over it. But there are also occasions, and this year may frankly be one of those occasions, it's up for the legislature to decide whether we would do a bonding bill in an odd-numbered session. But it's very clear that the statute's aligned to an even-year capital bonding bill process.
Thank you.
Proceed.
So I mentioned what a forecast is. November and February are the forecast. The Minnesota Management and Budget estimates the state revenues and expenditures. Forecast, and this is critical, always assume the continuation of current law as the basis for those estimates. The November forecast sets the stage for the governor's budget and the legislative session, but February is what we create the budget on. I put this slide up here because I wanted members to hear that a forecast does not include policy changes. The point is it's an enactment, or it's a representation of what the current laws for new data and new assumptions would be. If you just came back and enacted the forecast, here's what that price would be. So it ends up being a reference point typically for many of the legislative deliberations that you will have. This gives you, we're beginning to drill specifically into K-12. So this is the K-12 all funds budget. It's about 88% general fund. And so this committee really is a general fund story. There are some small other funds. If you were to see this chart for the environment and the natural resources budget area, you'd see a lot more other funds that are related to that conversation. In K-12, we have about 11.3% federal funds based on end-of-session data. We just yesterday got the end of the all funds tracking for the November forecast. So this reflects the data as of summertime. But the November forecast data for the general fund we do have. So now I'm just looking at the general fund. So remember, it was mostly general fund. And that black number doesn't show up very well. It's just my terrible eyesight. 81.3% of the conversation in this committee is about the general education. I shouldn't say conversation, but the money is about 81.3%. The next largest piece of the
Senator
pie.
Hoffman. Senator Wigger, Mr. Nauman, in the biennial budget, do those numbers also include the Medicaid reimbursement on third-party pay for services provided to school districts that are medically related?
Mr. Nauman?
I'm just thinking, Senator. No.
Okay.
13.3% is special education spending, and then some of the smaller groupings that we'll talk about later. These pieces of the pie are roughly organized as the bill has typically been organized. And I think the key piece to take away from this is how much of the K-12 spending is the general education formula. This is a relatively simplified version of the K-12 spreadsheet that you have in your packets. I will skip past it unless there's questions. It just gives you some history on some of the big buckets, again, general education being the largest piece. And this is the property tax tracking. Again, you can see how those numbers lay out. We've just simplified it for this slide. This slide shows you a little bit of trend over time. The orange circles up at the top show from 1998 all the way through 2015. The total K-12 spending, it's not adjusted by inflation or any changes in that way. It's just actual dollars. You can see a couple of noteworthy stories. In the 2003 period, there was a large increase in state aid and a commensurate decrease in the property tax. That was Governor Ventura's so-called big plan when the general education levy was bought out by the legislature during the 2001 session. Another interesting note is the 2010 period where the stimulus dollars to support education finance were put in to states throughout the country by the federal government. So we saw a decrease in education state aid and an increase on the federal side of things. And I've highlighted those on the slide. I think those are interesting notions, but it didn't change the overall revenue. So what we did with the ERA funds was support the level of spending with federal dollars. This is a notion that we talked about a little bit. It's sort of a conceptually how we equalize many formulas in Minnesota. Typical examples of this are operating capital. We will talk about that in a moment. The equity formula, notably the operating referendum, all work with a blend of both state aid and property taxes. And typically how this works is if you visualize the districts numbered 1 through 6 along the bottom as increasing in property wealth per kid, and then the total revenue value per pupil along the left side of the axis. And if you were to visually draw a horizontal line across the slides at, say, $500, and this is drastically simplified, but district number one is going to receive 100% state aid using this. And then district number three is going to be more or less 50-50. So the first part of their, for a given amount of revenue, they'll have to raise the first $250 or so off of state, off of the property tax levy, and the balance will come in the form of state aid. And then at some point you move past that blend of state aid and property tax levy, and it becomes 100% levy. This line where that break occurs is the equalizing factor, and that is a policy tool that's available to this committee as it thinks about education finance. In other words, you could inject state aid as a policy option to change the slope of that line and inject more state aid. That's one option that's available. Does that make sense? Okay. So again, now we're focusing just on the general education and referendum programs. Here, the point of this slide is for fiscal year 2013. I wanted you to see, now we're looking at just at that 88.1% of the education spending that is general education. The vast majority of that is the basic formula allowance. And that's one of the simplest formulas that we have. Most of it is that piece. All these others are additional formulas that are designed to accomplish various policy goals, and we'll talk through those in a moment. Here's the basic revenue formula allowance. There's a little bit of history here on the right side. It's a $4.9 billion program. It's calculated as the number 5224 in the current year multiplied times the pupil count. Now you can see why the pupil count matters. So whatever those counts are, multiplied times that number. I've shown this slide in the past, and Mr. Cook has said to me, you know, it'd be a really good idea to unpack that a little bit so you can see how the weights affect, because 5224 multiplied times a weighted and marginalized count doesn't show the real per pupil calculation that's built under the number as a result of the weights. So if you divide it out by AMC, the unweighted, unmarginalized count, you see that the per pupil amount is about $6,000, a little bit more. And I think that's a useful point to keep in mind, that the weights do have they hide some of the conversation. It's useful to see that. Extended time revenue is another formula. It's also a pretty simply calculated formula. The revenue is equal times the extended time formula allowance, which is 4601, hasn't changed since this formula was created, I think, back in the 2003 timeframe, times the extended time pupil units. We can talk about those if there are questions, but these are basically students that are taking classes after the normal school day. There's no requirement that the basic formula and the extended time formula must be equal, although they were when it was first created. This formula is not what we call linked. So if you add money to the basic formula allowance, you are not adding money to this formula. That's a separate legislative decision. It's about $71.1 million in this formula. Compensatory formula. This is the formula that gets a lot of conversation in a lot of different quarters. It's a formula to give districts additional funding for students that are what we call eligible for free and reduced lunch. That's our measurement of poverty. We used to use an AFDC count, but in the 1997 timeframe, during some of the welfare reforms at the state government, at the federal level, that AFDC count ceased to become a useful measure because people began time limiting out over time. So we switched the formula over to a free and reduced lunch count. Districts receive higher amounts of compensatory revenue based on their concentration of poverty at each school. Most of the revenue must be allocated to the site where the revenue was generated and used there, although there are some exceptions. And compensatory revenue is equal to a district's compensatory units subtracting 215 times the basic formula allowance. So what we're saying here is this formula is linked. So if you add money to the basic formula allowance, you are also adding money into the compensatory formula. The most recent estimate shows this at $460 million. Limited English proficiency. The current state of the art in the conversation about students that don't speak English refers to this formula as it's still titled in statute as limited English proficiency, although many folks refer to this as the ELL formula, English Language Learner Program. I can remember when I was a kid there were other names for this type of formula, but it does go, that is the formula that we're talking about here. It provides revenue to assist students whose English language ability needs improvement. It's comprised of two pieces. A regular formula and a concentration formula. The regular formula is $700 multiplied times the greater of 20 or the LEP units. So if you have just one LEP eligible student, that pupil, it establishes a floor of 20 and multiplied times the units, or multiplied times 700. And then a concentration formula, which is 250 multiplied times the LEP students, times the LEP unit, so you get a concentration factor. Both formulas generate money, and the sum of the two it generates $40.1 million in fiscal 13. Sparsity formula. This formula matters a great deal to a small subset of school districts in the state. Districts, there are two pieces to it. There's an elementary sparsity and a secondary sparsity. To be eligible for the secondary sparsity, a district must have 400 ADMs or less within a statutorily determined measure and a statutorily determined measurement of isolation. It depends on a logarithm, and we could spend a lot of time talking about that, but it's essentially a geographic measurement, and you have to have very few kids. The idea here is that there are some fixed costs within a school district or within a school area, and some school districts generate a fair bit of money as a result of that, just because the act of the normal calculation of X amount times a formula allowance may not generate enough money for some of those rural Greater Minnesota isolated school districts. There's also a secondary piece of this, the elementary sparsity, which to be eligible for the elementary sparsity, schools within a district must be located 19 or more miles from the next nearest elementary school and have 20 or fewer pupils per grade. So we're talking about the smallest school districts. This formula does tend to create a bit it hasn't historically generated a lot of conversation, but for those school districts to get it, it's a meaningful formula for them. And there's $24.8 million. I'll also mention that this formula is also linked. So you add money to the formula allowance, you are adding some dollars here. Transportation sparsity. This is one of my favorites for a misnamed formula. The reason is a lot of folks look at it and say, there's our transportation formula, right? It says transportation, so it must be money that we have to use for transportation. That's not true. It began as a hold harmless provision back, I think, in 1995 for the occasion when the legislature chose to roll the basic roll the old transportation formula onto the basic formula allowance. At that time, on the average, the transportation formula represented about 4.85% of the basic formula allowance. And we created this formula to deal with the overburdens that some school districts have on transportation costs that we knew about at the time. And we generated this formula to hold them harmless and give them some extra money so that they weren't deleteriously affected as a result of that. But there's no requirement that they have to spend those dollars on transportation. $61.5 million. Small schools was a new formula in the last couple of years. It provides additional revenue to school districts with less than 1,000 pupil units. Charter schools are not eligible. I should mention throughout all of these that charter schools are treated like school districts for all these formulas. But this one, they're not eligible for, and that's because we said in law that they weren't. The fewer pupils an eligible district has, the more money the formula generates per pupil. The formula is 5224 multiplied times the AMCPUs times this calculation. 1,000 minus your AMCPUs divided by 1,000, and then we discount it by 10%. It's only $15.8 million. Now, the 5224, the sharp eye will say, hey, that number is the same as the basic formula allowance. Is this linked as well? The answer is no. We burned it into law as 5224, so it does not change if you change the basic formula allowance. But right now, it's the same number. So it can be a little bit confusing. Operating capital. This formula inside general education has to be used for specific purposes, for repair and maintenance of facilities, acquisition of land, picking up drop bags, purchasing or leasing equipment, or purchasing books. The revenue must be placed in the operating capital account in the general fund. There is a index that's part of the formula that helps school districts with slightly older buildings, and that's the MCI, and it's 1 plus the average age of the school buildings divided by 100. There's a series of allowances that are built inside the formula. There's a technology piece, an equipment piece, and that facilities piece, which is multiplied times the MCI. So you see these three allowances ultimately get multiplied times the basic, times the AMCPUs of the school district. So the formula essentially looks like that. Districts with learning year programs, these are programs for after hours, also receive an additional $30 at the learning year site. So again, here's the formula. This formula is split aid and levy. It's $197.1 million in fiscal 13 as part of the budget cutting that we were doing in the 2013 session. We converted the legislature converted some of the state aid, the all state aid program, into an aid and levy program. And now the levy is $114 million and $83.1 million of it is aid in its recent estimates. Equity revenue is perhaps one of the most fun to talk about because there's a good legislative history associated with it. And I don't say good in terms of this is a positive thing. There's a lot of legislative history on it. It's one of the more complex formulas. It's now got four pieces. It started off as a formula that was designed to help school districts that were having trouble passing operating referenda, or that was the theory, because of a low property tax base. And it is a formula that is based on revenue that school districts receive from other formulas. So this formula is dependent upon other formulas. It was first created in 99, as I said, and it's been frequently amended and adjusted to accomplish legislative goals, and it now contains four separate. It's sort of a fiscal analyst's dream to play with this formula to accomplish a legislative intent. So the conference committee perhaps would say, we want to do thus and so, and House and Senate staff would say, well, let's look at the equity formula. This is one that we can use. But it's gotten to the point where it's one that you may want to look a little bit more closely at. So it's equalized, and that it used to be state aid originally, and it's been equalized now, so that's $92.6 million of revenue. The levy is $72.9, and the aid is $19.7. Because of the complexity of this one, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it. So the first portion is that portion that was intended to deal with the low property wealth. And what we do first is segregate school districts between the greater Minnesota area and districts within the seven-county metro region. You have to have your administrative office within the seven-county metro region to be in that metro pot. And within a region, districts are ranked top to bottom based on their essentially their operating referendum per AMCPU. It says basic, and the law does say basic and referendum, but the basic is the same for everyone, so it's really the operating referendum. Districts below the 95th percentile are eligible for revenue, except Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth were made ineligible. All eligible districts receive $13 per kid. That's the simple part. Districts with an operating referendum, if you have one, or even a dollar. In some cases, school districts pass a dollar to get money off this sliding scale, are eligible to receive additional equity revenue based on the district's percentile ranking. Top to bottom, 95th percent or lower, you're eligible. And we compute first a regional equity gap, the gap between the 95th percentile and the 5th percentile on your basic and your operating referendum. So you get a dollar value for that. And then we measure what's called the district equity gap. So let's say the district at the 50th percentile. We measure the gap between the 95th percentile and each district, each eligible district. And then we create an equity index, which is the district equity gap over the regional equity gap. That gives you a percentage. And then that percentage gets laid into this formula. $13 added to $75 times the equity index multiplied times the AMCPUs. So essentially that 75 gets discounted by the further, the closer you are to the 95th percentile. So the district at the 90th percentile would not get very much of that $75, but the district at the 5th percentile would get virtually all of it. That makes sense? Then we've added some more parts. Equity 2, program directed at small rural school districts, provides revenue to districts based on a computed allowance multiplied times the district's pupil units. The allowance is equal to the difference between 10% of the statewide average referendum per AMCPU and the actual district's referendum revenue per AMCPU, but it can't exceed $100,000. So it's just for the small school districts. Then Equity 3, told you that there were some formulas that were built on other formulas, is for districts in the metro area alone. And the way this one works is, the program is designed to recognize the, at the time that it was passed, there was a belief that there were higher costs in the metro area. And so this formula multiplies what you receive off of Equity 1 and Equity 2 multiplied times 1.25. So you just get a higher amount by virtue of being in that 7-county metro area. And then finally, Equity 4. For all school districts, so that above 95th percentile doesn't apply, $46 times your AMCPUs. Sounds a lot like the basic formula allowance, except that nothing else is linked to this. Okay. Take a breath. Gifted and talented. Barb Secor in the House was the chair for a couple of years, and she was the author of this provision. Provides districts with additional dollars for staff development and to develop local programs for gifted and talented students. It's not calculated based on the gifted and talented students, but instead we use the total pupil count, but multiply it times only $9. And there's about $11.5 million for that program. I like the graphics. I know Senator Weaver will like those, too.
I do.
Really nice.
Gifted and talented. Transition revenue. Sometimes when we make budget changes in K-12, there has been a history of creating other formulae for the purposes of offsetting a larger policy. 2003 was a good example of that. We were making a series of changes to the K-12 formulas to balance the overall budget. And to hold harmless school districts, we created what's called the Transition Revenue Program. It's called Transition because we thought that would only be a short formula, but it's now permanent and hasn't gone away. It was new in fiscal 2004, and as I said, it was used to create budget savings. The revenue is calculated as... This is a mouthful, so bear with me. The difference between a district's 2003-2004, that fiscal year, basically fiscal 04, general education revenue per pupil, the amount that we calculated new that year, and one of two factors. The lesser of the district's 03-04 revenue had no law changes been made by the 2003 legislature, or the forecast in February for the district's 2002-03 revenue. And beginning in 05, it became a mix of aid and levy. So then that allowance got essentially codified and carried forward, and we multiply it times each successive year's pupil count. $29.6 million of aid, and you'll see that it's mostly a levy program at this point. QCOMP. In law, it's called Alternative Teacher Compensation. It was designed by the Pawlenty during the Pawlenty era to create incentives for districts to pay teachers based on merit rather than the traditional seniority steps and lanes program or schedule. Districts are required to commit to paying teachers based on merit in addition to the steps and lanes process. Qualifying districts will receive up to $250 per pupil, both in the aid and levy mix. Not all eligible, I put eligible in quotes here, air quotes, will qualify. And the Department of Education determines the qualifying district. So districts and teachers and administration essentially have to commit to this, develop a plan, submit that plan to the Department of Education, and if that plan is approved, then the money turns on. But there's an overall financial cap of essentially $100 million, an aid cap of $75 million and $24 million in levy. So that's not enough for every school district in the state if they all agreed to do this for them all to participate. And that was a budget mechanism at the time, but it has continued forth and hasn't been adjusted since it was originally enacted. To generate some savings in 2009 and 11, we limited participation in the program, but that limitation has since expired. And the total spending right now is $69.8 million, or the total revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nauman, how is that? It's under the general education funding, but how is that fair if a district is eligible but actually doesn't receive any money?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, you and I have talked about this a variety of times. I think what we're getting at here is that the general education program for many other programs is one that if you have a pupil count and you multiply it times a factor and you fit that criteria, the money turns on. This, I believe, is a residual that I think there was a sense that it would act as an incentive for school districts to enter this program, but there wasn't sufficient dollars at the front end. I think there is a policy discussion for you to wrestle with to decide whether you think, using whatever paradigm you wish for fairness, to determine whether you think that this is still the way you want to go, or maybe you'd like to expand it for all districts and get rid of the cap. I hasten to note that the revenues are underneath the cap right now. You haven't filled it all the way up. And maybe there is something to evaluate there.
So Mr. Chairman, last session when we passed a requirement that teachers had to go through an assessment process and some of their evaluation was going to be based on performance, that wasn't a requirement that was a general requirement that all districts had to participate. And so it seems odd that the districts that are in there are getting money to do that, but then a whole bunch of districts, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's probably about half of the districts in the state don't get any money, but they're going to have to do the same basic evaluations and assessments that the districts that the other half are getting money for. I think it's a big issue for us to talk about.
Yeah. We clearly have jurisdiction. Okay. Senator Torsby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stump, actually, I have been meeting with each member of the policy committee to hear their perspective and priorities, and this has come up at every single meeting. So it is clear that the members want to review this and figure out how, kind of with respect to policy, what are the requirements, review what we had before, what we are asking the districts to do now, and where do we need to go. Clearly, from the policy perspective, we're going to be doing a thorough review this year in terms of, existing policy, new policy that is being proposed as, for implementation. And then we will obviously coordinate with Mr. Chair to figure out, the budget implications and bring that to this committee. But this, by far, and testing have been the two issues that the policy committee members want to review.
Thank you.
Noted. Ms. Nauman.
Thank you, Senator. How are we doing?
Very well.
Okay, good. Any other questions on this slide? Okay.
And members, keep in mind we will be hearing from Dr. Melcher tomorrow, and we're going to hear about these particular items, but also what does a group, the workforce or the working group on finance, how they would like to change these things. And I'm sure you're getting guidance on this as well. So we'll be pursuing this in further depth tomorrow and beyond.
So I'd like to wrap up general education with a discussion about operating referendum. It is defined in statute as part of the general education program. Operating referendum is those occasions I'm sure you've confronted at the ballot box when the school district has asked you to increase their dollars per pupil. You see a number of $400, $500, sometimes even higher, for operating expenses. It usually is accompanied by a commitment on the part of the school board that we want these dollars to do A, B, C, and D. The operating referendum has a fairly substantial history, but at this point I'm just going to walk you through what current law says. So it is approved by the school district voters to provide districts with additional operating referendum. The overall statutes limit the size of that referendum. It cannot exceed 26% of the formula allowance. So here's the last example. It's the last. There's a few in non-public pupil linkage, a few linkages in the non-public pupil formula. But this is the last primary linkage formula where if you add money to the basic formula allowance, you are recognizing, you add a dollar, you get 26 cents on the cap. So there is an overall limit. Some districts may exceed that hard, what we call the hard cap, if they had a higher referendum when the limit was put in place. And since 2003, those school districts, those so-called grandfather districts, are allowed to add inflationary growth. However, there's a big never mind here. If you happen to be a school district that's eligible for sparsity, there is no cap. Most of them never get close, but there's a few exceptions there. What happened there? Maybe we'll work off the hard slide for this one. I'm not quite sure why that's happening. Let's work off the hard slide.
Sorry about that.
The revenge of Bill Gates. I'm going to remind myself what we had on here. So that formula is a mix of both property, depending on a school district's wealth, it's a mix of both aid and levy. And the higher a district's property wealth, the more referendum will be raised by levy. I'll add that we have not adjusted the equalizing factors at all since its inception, with one small exception. And this process is called equalization, but if you think about what's happened over your own property that you may own over the last 10 years, it's gotten more and more wealthy, so relative to more and more valued at higher amounts. So over time, school districts have begun to really look a lot more wealthy relative to the K-12 formulas, and they're getting priced off that formula. That's a real issue for both this committee and the tax committee to wrestle with. The basic formula here is the referendum revenue is equal to the allowance times the RMCPUs, and it was a $859.8 million revenue program in the current year. Most of that is levy. As I mentioned, this is equalized, and I'd like to kind of walk you through a little bit about how that works. The first $600, I think it's $700, I think I didn't update that, of approved referendum revenues equalized at $476,000 per RMCPU. And the next $758, or the cap minus, again, sorry, there's not an update here, minus $700, so the next $658 per RMCPU is equalized at $2,700. Or $270,000 per kid. School districts qualify for sparsity, I mentioned earlier, have an exception. So now we'll walk you through this formula. This is an example where we've got moving slides and numbers, so I'd like to ask you to concentrate on the screen behind me. So you go to the ballot box, and we have a hypothetical district with 2,000 resident marginal cost pupil units and a referendum market value, our tax base, of $250 million. And they asked the voters to approve a $750 per pupil referendum. If the voters approve, we know that what the revenue will be. This is the simple part, 750 times the 2,000, or 1.5 million. But now, how much of it is aid and how much of it is levy becomes the important question. Here's our pupil units, our market value, and our approved allowance that we established on the previous slide. First thing we have to do is establish a referendum market value per pupil, and we do that by dividing the pupils into the total market value of the district. We get $125,000 per kid. So we know we'll have some equalization with that number. First thing we do is calculate the first tier. Again, this is a little bit dated, but $600 times the 2,000 equals 1.2 million. That's first tier revenue. The second tier is the 750 minus the 600 for 150 on the second tier. We multiply that number times the pupil count, and we get 300,000. We could have just subtracted one from the other, but I wanted you to see the pieces. Now, the next thing we do is calculate the levy, and we do it twice because we've got two slopes that we're working with. Take the revenue from each tier, the 1.2 and the 300, and divide the referendum market value for our district over the equalizing factors and get a new number. 315,126 on the first tier and 138,889 on the second tier. These are our levy amounts. Together, they're 454,000. I mentioned before the way the actual calculation works is you take the revenue, subtract the levy that you calculated based on the tax base of the district, and there's your aid. So this district gets a fair bit of aid. 30.3%, 69.7%. When I first did this slide many years ago, there were a lot of districts that looked like this. There's very few now. Are there questions about that math? We won't ask you to do that math. We want you to be aware that it exists, and we'll help you through it if you have legislation that you intended to change that. Now, Senator Wieger, this is a good point for me to ask the timing. I want to make sure that I get to the shift calculations. I've got a few sheets here that talk about some of the other portions of that pie chart, most notably special ed. Maybe I can do the special ed slide and then skip to the skip to the shifts and then see if there's questions.
Yes.
Okay, so this is the second largest piece. And again, these groupings are based on the traditional groupings of the K-12 bill. This gives you an overall magnitude. There are two primary formulas in special ed, one, and they're both cost reimbursement formulas. The first is regular, and then the excess cost is a second formula for those school districts that have high overburdens on the costs associated with special ed costs. The regular aid for special education provides school districts with aid equal to 68% of the salaries of the special ed teachers and other ed essential personnel, 52% of contracted costs above the general ed formula, and 47% of supplies and costs with a maximum equal to $47 per kid. That's what the formula in law says. However, we haven't traditionally appropriated that amount because it's expensive. So what we've done is come in on the backside and established an overall cap, and then we prorate the amount that we actually that we appropriate to school districts each year to all school districts. However, the cap gets inflated year to year at an amount equal to 4.6%. There have been occasions in the past where that cap of that inflation cap, or that, I don't mean inflation, that growth cap has been turned off and then it's been reinstated. Similarly, excess cost provides additional special ed dollars to districts when their unreimbursed special ed costs equal 4.36% of the general ed revenue, of their general ed revenue, and the state total amount on the excess cost revenue is also the excess cost revenue is also capped and prorated to districts. Here the cap inflates at 2%. What I'm going to do now is skip to the shift discussion and encourage you, if we run out of time, to take a look at some of those other slides that mainly are budget sheets that are built into the overall spreadsheets. But they include a variety of programs in the in the Education Excellence section of the bill that's traditionally Article 2, money for facilities, both for charter schools and school districts, nutrition accounts, library accounts, which are in your jurisdiction, and you also get the honor of appropriating money to the Department of Education, the Purpich School for Arts Education, as well as the Faribault Academies, and there are small slides on those. How many shifts do we have? Looking. There's two. We have an aid payment shift, which relates to the schedule in which school districts are paid, and a so-called property tax recognition shift.
Page 52.
Yes, I'm sorry. My slide says 51. It might be 52.
Or 51.
Did I skip over something? Okay. The PTRS is sort of the forgotten shift. When we talk about shifts, most people are focused on the aid payment shift. So I'd like to unpack that a little. The aid payment shift is an adjustment to the balance of the current and final payment percentages, remembering back to our definitions at the front. We consider an unshifted environment when school aid payments are comprised of a combination of 90% of the current year's entitlement added to 10% of the prior year's entitlement, and the overall appropriation to schools is metered out 23 payments throughout the year. It's roughly every 2 weeks, starting on about the 15th of July and ending in the middle of June. Now, somebody is going to say, why is 90-10 unshifted? Why do we consider that unshifted? It's a great question. It's a bit of a residual of history, and it's certainly an issue for you all to wrestle with. It doesn't have to be that way. Part of the tradition and the reason the shifts exist at all has to do with how school districts clean up their pupil counts at the very end of the school year. And the last thing we want to do is to go back and take dollars away from school districts from the prior year because the pupil counts were off. So having that lagging payment has traditionally provided extra dollars at the end to clean up the final payments for school districts. Is 10% the right number as a lagging payment? It's a great question. It might be something to wrestle with Dr. Melcher when he comes before the committee. Property tax recognition shift is an accounting entry. This is where it gets kind of technical. That takes a portion of a school district's property tax revenue and moves it back 1 year. So moves it essentially from fiscal year 12 to fiscal year 11. And the second step is to reduce the aid in an amount equal to the property tax shifted. It generates one-time savings by doing that. Essentially, you're giving, in the year that you institute a property tax recognition shift, three property tax payments. And we'll talk about that in a second. Senator Bonoff, you keep smiling at me. Is that good news or bad?
Senator Bonoff.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, I just sometimes think that we're really never going to pay that property tax recognition shift back, and so that was probably what you sensed.
Okay.
And you might just explain to the committee the current status of that and what would mean if we did pay it back versus if we didn't.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So bear with me. I want to make sure that we've all got a foundation of what they mean first. So I like moving numbers on slides, so bear with me. This is my way of offering an explanation of how the aid payment shift works. And I use $100 as the entitlement. This is the amount that each year's formulas generate. I've simplified it greatly, so keep in mind these are really, we're talking billions of dollars, but for the purposes of this discussion, because it makes the percentages easy, we're talking about $100 statewide for all the entitlements under the jurisdiction of the committee. And then we have a payment schedule. Again, 90-10 is our unshifted environment, so what we're looking at here is what does unshifted look like and the way that the dollars get metered out. First, you have a current year payment and a final payment, right? So the $90 90% of 100 is $90, is the current payment, and then there's a final payment that comes from the prior year. And you don't even have to be a math whiz to see that it's all going to be $100, right? So then here's the mechanics of how a shift works. This is these are the actual shift values that we used in the FY 10-11 biennium and that were enacted in the 12 and 13 biennium. I have another slide that will show where we're at right now, and I'll talk about that in a second. So again, our $100, and in 2009 we were on a 90-10 schedule. And the legislature enacted reductions to the 90% number of 73 and 70, and then subsequently 60 ad infinitum into the future. So the current payment now changes. In 2010, it went from 90 down to 73. The lagging payment stayed the same in fiscal 10. So we were adding the 73 to 10, and then when we changed it down to 70, we were adding the 70 to 27. Notice the 10 changes. It goes to 27. So if you reduce the current year payment, you're increasing the final payment. And that dichotomy or that balance occurs when you increase, when you buy the shift back. So then in 2012, we went down to 60 and we created savings, 60 added to the 30, and then the 60 added to the 40, and you end back up in fiscal 13, theoretically, at $100, which is kind of where you started. So it's not a loss of dollars. It's just a timing, a cash flow issue. It essentially is a public policy. It's public policy behind the difference between the state's cash accounting and the accrual accounting that school districts use. Is that how that works? Is clear?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so now, here's where we're at now. Again, we've got the same entitlements. The payment schedule for 2009 is the same. And for 10 and 11, the schedule we had already established. I'll tell you where this comes from in a second, but the shifts, the percentages changed in both the November forecast or February forecast of last year, increasing it from the 60% we saw on the previous slide to 64.3. And then in the most recent forecast, we're now at 82.5. So you can see how these dollars then change. So we're beginning to buy the aid payment shift back from the 60% level that was enacted 2 years ago. And the way this works, when you put real dollars on this, the February 11 forecast, the February 12 forecast bought back $313.4 million, and the November 12 forecast bought back $1.323.7 million to get us back to those numbers. And I'm remembering Senator Bonoff's question, but let me get through the property tax recognition shift, and then we'll open one of the pages that's in the handout, and we can talk through how to read that. So a property tax recognition shift relates when school districts recognize their property taxes. And prior to a change, property taxes in Minnesota are paid in roughly May and October. School districts, by law and accounting rules, when we're not shifting, recognize them all in the fiscal year together. So that May payment actually gets recognized after July 1st. And then the October payment is obviously recognized in that year. I'm using fiscal 11 and 12 here because this is the year when we instituted the property tax recognition shift. So then, now we're going to shift. So here's how this works. We enacted a legislative change that said school districts, I should say this was originally enacted by an allotment and then subsequently codified by the legislature. We moved the recognition from the 12 fiscal year to the 11 fiscal year. So now school districts have three property tax payments in that particular, in fiscal 11. Two from the previous year, from fiscal 11 that were based on the statute, where the law was, plus this early recognition. And that increased their levy revenue by $528.4 million in fiscal 11. So they got this big infusion of dollars. And then we do an aid cut in the same amount. And then this just continues to roll forward every year. So they still get two payments in fiscal 12, but one of them is the earlier recognition. Does that make sense? This one we forget about. I don't mean that if I that shorthand, I don't mean to say forget about it. I mean that this is one that people often don't think about. But it is still out there. We also have a law that was passed in 2004. Because the shifts have been historically used as a de facto budget reserve, in other words, this is a place we often turn to help balance budgets, we have passed a law. The legislature in 2004 passed a law to make a contingent buyback. And when the forecasts return to surplus, there are automatic buybacks that occur of these shifts. The shifts are paid back when the commissioner of MMB determines that, in fact, there is a positive unrestricted budgetary general fund balance, what you all call a surplus, at the close of the biennium. And the first thing that happens is we make sure that the cash flow account is filled up to $350 million, that the budget reserve is at $653, and then we start paying back the aid payment shift. That's how we started increasing those percentages, was this law. So we got our cash flow back to balance up to $350, and then the budget reserve was at $653, and then we started whittling away at the aid payment shift. And then after that, once the aid payment shift is bought back, then the property tax recognition shift, and then there's one small payment to the airport fund that's also on the pecking list. This process has been used once before. It completely bought back the 2002 and 2003 session shifts that when we went down to, I believe we went down to 80-20 that year. And then the 2010 through 12 shifts buybacks have already begun. Here's the statute that governs that, so I'm not going to speak to it, but you can see the language. Here's a little bit of history. A few years back, Senator Michelle said, oh, this, thanks for giving us this, but what's all the history on this? So I put these two slides together that show some of the history of occasions when the legislature has enacted changes to the shift or when forecasts have bought them back. So we did go to 80-20 during the 2002-2003 time. And then we began to buy them back. So this is some history, and this is more recent history. And we've got it updated now. So you can see that the last two entries are the forecasted shift changes.
So,
Senator Bob.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman, I guess if we were to not pay it back, we would actually have to change the statute to say we weren't going to pay it back.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, that's absolutely correct. Under current law, if there is a surplus in February, we will buy more shift. And that you may recall from the November forecast discussions that, in fact, the budget balance at the end of, after all the discussion when Dr. Sintz and Commissioner Showalter are done, they say our budget balance is zero. And that's because every nickel gets allocated somewhere because of this automatic buyback. Now, the good budgeteer in me would suggest, I mean, there's obviously policy issues for you all to wrestle with. But if you use it as a one-time smoothing of the budget in bad times, there's certainly something to think about in terms of whether you ought to be paying it back. And that's what the legislature thought back in the 2004 time frame when it passed the law to say, if we're using it a budget reserve, we ought to pay it back as if it were a budget reserve, and that's why it's put in that pecking order.
Okay.
But certainly, this legislature could reevaluate it and think about it differently.
Yes, sorry.
So, on the same token, then, if the legislature passes a budget that actually takes us out of a surplus situation, then the repayment of that shift will automatically stop at that point.
The minute the shift goes back to 90-10, We move back, we move on to the property tax recognition shift, and when that property tax recognition shift is completely paid back, in other words, we've added enough money to put the school districts back on the recognition of their property taxes in the subsequent year, then that pecking order ends.
Okay.
And once it ends, then we'll start generating, again, we're looking hypothetically into the future.
Right.
If we had a surplus after that, a positive, what we budgeteers call a positive unrestricted budget balance, you would then have dollars that would be available for additional spending, reductions in taxes, or a whole variety of options. Because of the language which restricts the positive unrestricted balance to buy back first cash flow, budget reserve, and the two shifts and the small payment to the airport fund, those five things, you will have a zero forecast whenever the revenues are exceeding the spending. It ends up at zero because you buy the shifts back. I'm sorry, Senator, I may have given you more than you wanted here.
Okay. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Weber. Senator Stone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think just it's probably important to just take a minute and put some of the pieces together, because we'll probably be, the legislature at some point will be facing some of the issues of deficits or needs of maybe using the some of the tools again. It happened in the early 80s. It periodically happened. At that time when we it took us about 17 years to pay back the school shifts. But in the last 10 years, we've seen the worst kind of economic times where the economy slipped down, the federal government, ended up helping us out for a few years with federal aid, but the state got to the point where we actually had to go into school district fund balances and borrow from those fund balances, which was not a good, I don't think is a good approach, and consequently, I think, Senator Bonhoeff, it was your legislation that ended that, because there was another statute that said the state could not go out on the open market and borrow money from traditional lenders. So now we put in place the option that the state can go out and borrow money on the open market, short-term money. So we don't need to go into the school district's fund balances. In fact, can't. And so I think as we move through some of these economic difficult times, we figure out what's probably best. When the state did go in and borrow money from fund balances, it just hit certain districts. And I think that changes the way board members look at whether they want to have a reserve in their district. And so I think the whole discussion of should we absolutely prevent the state from ever shifting again, I don't know. I've seen it in the years that I've been here three times, where it helped out the state temporarily. So I think that option is still, at least in my mind, something that can be used as an important fiscal tool. But I don't think, I think some things we should, should eliminate. But it's I think all part of a, because the budget is for K-12 is so large, it is important to kind of look at kind of the history of what happens when the economic times swing back and forth. Thank you, Senator Stumpf. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Stumpf, I I'm not disagreeing with you, but I have said all along that the K-12 shifts that the state have done is bad policy. But quite frankly, when you talk to superintendents and ask them, would you prefer that we hold your funding flat so that we can not do this shift, or just give you a little teeny bump so we don't have to do this shift, or would you prefer that we do this shift and give you a little bump in funding like we did this last budget session? They greatly prefer the latter because they know they're going to get the money and they can borrow to cover cash flow if they need it, almost 0% interest. I think 0.4 was the average interest rate. So it can be a tool that both sides don't necessarily one side can benefit and the other side doesn't get hurt too much and actually kind of prefers that approach. So I have said all along that it's bad policy. And I did want to note here, too, for some of the newer members on the committee, Senator Sumpf, you mentioned back in the 80s it took 17 years to get that paid back. And you look in the recent years, it was paid back in 2 years. We're on track now to pay it back in just a few years. And that's a result of what Mr. Nauman has explained to us, that automatic payback mechanism. It didn't exist back then. I think it was 2004 that we put that into statute. And that was good policy, and it has played out well and makes that whole school shift ability for the state less bad policy than at least it was in the past, in my opinion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I can now return to Senator Bonoff's question and call your attention to that sheet that we handed out, the history of the education shifts. This is an even better – this doesn't show all the policy changes that we had, but what it allows you to do is quickly scan across, and there's this inevitable question: how much of the shift is left? And in the current fiscal year, fiscal 13, you scroll all the way down on the left side to fiscal year 13, here's what this tells you. It says that the property tax recognition shift is at a 48.6% shift, and that the total shift value, the accumulation of the original shift plus new property taxes that have occurred since that shift was put in place, is estimated to have a $555 million price tag. And then we are at we started the fiscal year at an 5.7% shift. And at this point, based on the November forecast, we're at an 17.5% shift. And the amount that's remaining is $545 million, and the total is $1.1 billion. That's what that tells you. It also allows you to say, if lightning doesn't strike this year, but we can wave our magic wand and we will have the revenue, the resources to pay back the shift in a future year. So through the projection period based on the data that we have, the shift, if we can't pay it off until 2017, if nothing else happens and we don't have a positive balance in a future forecast, until then, the cost will have grown to $1.2 billion. It tells you to look at it, the ability to look at it over time. And, of course, that number would change if resources became available, for example, in the February forecast, we would then update these numbers for that. Senator Bonoff, does that answer the question you were posing?
Okay.
Okay, Ms. Noma, we're going to have you wrap up.
I have two more slides. If you need more information, there's some links here. This with a couple of updates because of the staff that missed the fixes will be posted on the web probably later today. There's the Legislative Reference Library, Management and Budget, links to the Department of Education and other places. This is your K-12 staff. Hang on to this slide. This is useful because it has phone numbers on who you should be contacting for various things. So the caucus staff, all the way from Ed Cook down to Caitlin Schneider, who's the new committee legislative assistant, and then the nonpartisan staff can be reached on this slide. It's the first time in 15 years I haven't been on this slide, so, Mr. Chair, I wish you all the best of luck. The final slides are the appendices, just some trend data. And, again, if you have questions about this or anything else, I'm happy to help if I can, but I am looking forward to handing this baton off if I haven't made that clear yet.
Ms. Nauman, thank you so much for the Service Committee and now to the Senate. And
beyond, we will definitely put save on this document. And in the future, we will have in the folder a save folder where you can put things or bring it back. So if you want to save this, suggest that. Bring it with you to your office. And I assume there is an online or electronic version that we can get. In fact, Eric, if you could, I think you mentioned that you might update a couple of the slide pieces. This would be a very good piece for sharing with school board members, others in your district, in your communications. That's what I would be doing. And so, if, assuming it's not copyrighted. And
Mr. Chair, no. We have previous year's versions of this briefing online in the presentation section of the Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis. And that link is on the slide with the links. So you can find previous versions, and hopefully by the end of today, time permitting, we will have this posted as well.
Thanks again, Eric. And members, reminder, we're meeting tomorrow, 8:30. We're going to hear from Dr. Melcher on the group that's been working on how do we reform this whole ed finance system that we have. There is a hard copy document that will be distributed tomorrow, and I know several of you have already read the report, but we will today send you an electronic version as well. If you want to just brief yourself, there's a summary available, but we'll be reviewing that tomorrow. And then the following week on Wednesday, we hope to hear from the department on the governor's budget. So any further questions at this point? Yes, Senator Huffman.
Senator Wigger, Eric, thank you. Slides 42 through 50, because of interest of time, but I think those are important that we get him to come back and explain to us the differences, in, especially when you look at the early childhood. You have some mix of federal, state, community education programs that I think would be very valuable for us to understand just from a budgetary standpoint where it all fits in the big picture.
And we'll hand, it's very important. We will be discussing that. We'll ask Bjorn as Epitone is hand it off to help in that discussion. So
thank you.
Thank you. There being no further business, the committee's adjourned.